You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Andrew Harvey is an internationally acclaimed poet, novelist, translator, mystical scholar, and spiritual teacher. He has published over 20 books, including Son of Man and The Return of the Mother. Harvey is a fellow of All Souls College, Oxford, and has taught at Oxford University, Cornell University, the California Institute of Integral Studies, and the University of Creation Spirituality, as well as various spiritual centers throughout the U.S. He was the subject of the 1993 BBC film documentary, The Making of a Modern Mystic. And I can assure you, he's a modern mystic. We just had a nice conversation over dinner, and he's amazing. He is the founder of the Institute for Sacred Activism in Illinois. Ed Bacon, of course, as some of you already know, is the rector of All Saints Church in Pasadena, a 4,000-member multi-ethnic urban episcopal parish with a reputation for energetic worship, a radically inclusive spirit, and a progressive peace and justice agenda. Ed has been honored several times for his peace and interfaith work. In 2005 by the Islamic Center of Southern California, in 2006 by the ACLU of Southern California, the Islamic Shura Council, and Rainbow Push Coalition. In 2007, he was honored by the Pasadena NAACP and by the ACLU Pasadena Foothill Chapter. He is currently a guest host twice a month on Oprah's Soul series, which airs every Monday on Sirius XM Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Harvey and Ed Bacon.
So very, very good to see you. I have the great honor of interviewing my newest best friend, Andrew Harvey, whom I met this past March when he was in the Oprah Soul Series studio where I was working. He was about to be interviewed by my friend Elizabeth Lesser. I have been a fan of Andrew's for 20 years, I think. He began writing when he was 15, and I immediately picked up his books 12. At that point. 12, I'm sorry, Andrew. I've always been attracted to his mysticism, and then am very thrilled by this new volume of his, Hope, where he eloquently, lyrically, poetically describes that arc that all, I think, mystics traverse, and that is toward activism. And that's what makes mysticism healthy, and activism healthy is for mysticism and activism to be brought together. Mm. So we want to explore that, and I'm going to have the great, great joy of asking some questions and letting you in on the workings of a brilliant, first-rate mind and an absolutely transformative heart. So, Andrew, thank you for this moment.
Thank you so much. Lovely to be here.
I do want to say I would like for us to simply take a breath. And let that breath be in acknowledgement of something that Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said that I use as a mantra. And that is that in every moment, something sacred is at stake. Can we just pause for a second and bring our minds and our hearts and our collective beings around the truth that in this room, this night, something sacred is at stake for you, for me, and for the world. Thank you.
What a beautiful way to begin, and how unexpected. Thank you so much.
I think we're in for a lot of unexpected moments, Andrew. So... I've been attracted to you for many reasons, one of which is because you really are an interreligious person, a genuinely interreligious person. And I'm going to ask you a question about just on the religious level now, not about your spiritual. Please. But how in the world did you get exposed to so many religions from which you quote so generously? I mean, what is this interreligious world in your brain? How did you get introduced?
Well, I was born in India, so I was born into a world which was celebrated as sacred. I spent the first 9 years of my life in India, and I was born to Protestant parents, but I had a Hindu cook, a Muslim driver, a Catholic ayah, nanny who looked after me. And I think very early on, I understood osmotically that there was one divine and many, many different paths to the divine, because that is the genius of Hinduism. So many things came to me very young, before I formed my ego. I had an amazing experience as a child because I had a white Russian godmother, and she was a very extravagant person. She used to lie in gold lamé on her sofa and pretend that she had always been 62. She was in her 80s by the time this pretense wore a little thin. And she had extreme worldliness on one hand, but she was also a very holy person on the other, because she had a tremendous heart. And her best friend was the greatest living saint of the time, who was an immensely fat woman who used to go up and visit her most days and lie in bed with her and eat chocolates with her. And I used to go upstairs to be with these two extraordinary women. Every afternoon coming back from school, I'd jump in between them in the bed. And I had no idea at the time who I were lying next to. But Shanti, as her name was, used to tell me amazing stories about God. And she was one of the very few truly accredited reincarnation cases. So imagine this little boy lying between these two wild women in Delhi and the big woman in a white sari telling you about how when she died, she went to see Krishna, and Krishna turned up naturally because that's what Krishna would do, and said to her, look, you've been pretty good in this life, but there's something I want to ask you to do. Would you go down and heal people in my name? And she, of course, said, yes, I don't think you refuse Krishna at that kind of stage. And it turned out that as a little girl, she was walking down a street and she'd seen her ex-husband had gone up to him, told him where the money was hidden in the house, called him by the private name that they used to call each other when they made love, and had, in fact, with a group of English journalists, gone back to the village where she lived and had identified everything in that village. So she's one of the accredited cases of reincarnation, but she was also a supreme healer. She healed hundreds of thousands of people, thousands of people. So through those kinds of meetings and through the example of my family, which was tolerant and loving and open to all the religions, I really, from very early on, understood that there was one God, that life and the creation was divine, that the whole of reality was permeated by this great secret presence. And the other thing that India gave me, which has lasted very intensely in my life, is that India gave me an initiation into the glory of Islam, because I spent a lot of my childhood in Delhi, and Delhi has these amazing old Islamic tombs. And I was taken by my father when I was 4 to the Taj Mahal. And I experienced the Taj Mahal as a revelation of divine beauty. And my father told me the story of how the Emperor Shah Jahan had built the Taj Mahal, all of this magnificence, to celebrate his love for his wife. And later on, many years later, I discovered that the Emperor had been a Sufi, a mystic. But I think what happened to me in meeting the glory of Islam is that I got into connection with the pure stream of Islamic mysticism, which has culminated in my lifelong work with Rumi. So everything in my life begins in India. Mm. I was baptized in India, I was initiated in India. India gave me the gift of mysticism. India gave me the gift of the presence of the divine in and as everything. And it's a gift that has gone on flowering in my life. So I consider India my true home and my true mother.
Mm. So let's go from the level of religion. And I know you've already gone profoundly into the area of spirituality. But somewhere along the way and in the journey, Andrew Harvey's own spiritual narrative was taking place.
Yes.
So would you give us a sense, a taste of that?
My God.
Your own
yes.
spiritual experiences that no one else was kind of giving you, but they were nourishing it, but it was happening for you.
Oh, yes. But I think that if you're born in a world like that, you're in a natural non-dual state. So the magic is appearing.
Wait, what
inside
is a non-dual state?
A non-dual state is when you know that what you are participating in is an aspect of your huge, divinely graced identity. The whole universe is an emanation of divine consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone at the core of themselves, himself or herself, is one with that divine consciousness. So in my divine film, we're having this conversation. In your divine film, we're having this conversation. And in your divine film, you are listening with kindness and attention to this conversation. So that's a non-dual experience because there's no separation. There's the heart speaking to the heart, about the heart.
Mm.
And then in India, if you're born into a sacred culture which treats everything sacredly, you're naturally treated as a sacred being.
Mm.
So you experience things naturally sacredly. So I think I had many, many initiations as a child. I can think of two that were really important for me. The first was, my first memory is of eating mangoes. And I love mangoes because they're golden and they're incredibly potent and sweet. And the mango juice was running down my body and I felt such ecstasy and elation that there should be something so beautiful and so sweet and so intensely delicious in life. So for me, I was eating the Ananda, the divine Ananda. And I think the other real initiation of my life was the exact opposite initiation, because I was once on a very beautiful beach in India, in Mangalore, which is a very lovely seaside town. And I was with my grandmother, and it was a perfect day. My grandmother was wading in the shallow water, and she started to scream, I mean really scream, and she'd just been savaged by a stingray. And she collapsed on the beach, and my grandfather sucked the poison out of her wound, and she lay between life and death for 3 days, and I was very close to my grandmother. So to be actually there while this horror struck from this very peaceful place. So I think those two initiations symbolize the two aspects of the divine.
Mm.
The bliss aspect that dissolves the ego,
mm-hmm.
and the horror aspect that also dissolves the ego, because it reveals how precarious the games of the ego
mm-hmm.
are. So India gave me both those gifts very early on, and my whole life has been an attempt to marry the mango and the stingray.
Mm.
And to know God as both the mango and the stingray. That's very important. Otherwise you sentimentalize the divine. Otherwise you make the divine just the bliss. But the bliss isn't the only aspect. There's also terror and judgment and passion and ferocity and death and horror. And they're also divine. That's what I've discovered. That was India's gift to me, I think. And that's non-duality.
Right.
Because a non-dual relationship is a relationship of the one in you with the one outside you.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing is excluded from that relationship. No human being, no aspect of the creation, nothing that we call good and nothing that we call evil, nothing that we call beautiful and nothing that we call hideous, nothing that we call order and nothing that we call chaos. Because when you're in that relationship, everything is experienced as a manifestation of the one, of the divine. And India is an extraordinary culture because that knowledge is at the core of the Indian experience. So anybody who's blessed enough to live there as a child wakes up in that naturally. But I lost it because I had to be sent to England. This is something I'm going to argue about with God when I get to. I hope I will get that to the. Imagine what it is to be in a paradise where you're experiencing this intense union with reality and then to be sent at 9 years old to a school in southern England where you have to run naked up and down corridors and jump into cold baths and go running in the rain, which I loathed, and then be trapped in a culture which was emotionally incredibly violent and cold, after this culture that is so spontaneous and so physical and so tender. India is such a furnace of connection. And then to go to the exact opposite, England is the last stage of Dante's hell, in which everybody is frozen in total mutual disconnection. So I felt that being sent there as a child was like being put into a refrigerator with just enough of the refrigerator left open so that I could know that I was freezing to death. So then I overachieved ferociously and became a member of the English elite just as a way of coping with being in that culture. And that lost India for me. And I became a professor at Oxford and all of that. And that was a terrifying experience too, because I was truly trapped in an intellectual word game. Fundamentally, the people that I was with at Oxford, most of them believed that the ultimate revelation was irony.
Mm.
And that if you couldn't destroy something, you were not potent. Mm. And if you couldn't assert at all moments the primacy of reason and of the mind, there was something severely wrong with you, because you might be contaminated by the heart.
Mm.
Or the worst horror of all, you might be going through a mystical transformation and therefore being completely crazy.
Mm.
And I realized that I would die if I stayed in that atmosphere. So at the age of 25, I went back to India.
Mm.
And I didn't go back to visit an ashram or to get a Sanskrit name. I went back because I wanted to bathe again in the glory of my childhood knowledge of the world. I wanted to taste that water again. And what happened was that I did go back and actually had a series of overwhelming mystical transformations and experiences that set my life on a wholly different course. Because going back to India wasn't just going back to my childhood. It was actually going back at a time when I was broken enough to really begin to be open, to be initiated in the great truths of divine identity and non-dual consciousness. And
so will you share with us one or two of those experiences?
Yes.
And let me frame that question by sharing an experience I had while you were talking. I've had the great experience of being around the Dalai Lama and being around a good deal Desmond Tutu. And what strikes me about the commonality of those two people is their immense joy.
Yes.
Often bubbly joy.
Yes.
And a great deal of courage, of moral courage.
Yes.
Which I experience from your writing, from talking with your friends, and from being with you at
Thank
dinner.
You.
And now, my experience is that the kind of audacious joy and inclusive love that those two people and you show the world comes from some pretty amazing transformative spiritual experiences. So that's the framework in which I'm asking you to share with us something of these experiences that you had in India, which, when you returned, which have to be the root of this
yes.
thrilling being that you are.
Well, I'm very honored to be even thought of, let alone mentioned, in a sentence which includes Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. This is a first, so I'm going to savor it briefly. Thank you very much. I really don't feel that I'm worthy of cleaning their underpants or tying their shoe nails. These are two great heroes of the soul to me.
Point made.
But I think that it's a very beautiful thing you've just said about people who are living the divine experience are bubbling over with joy. How could they not be? If they're not, they're not living it. And I think the great signs of holiness are humor and tenderness. And both Desmond and His Holiness have that so much. I wanted to tell you the story about the mystical experience that changed my life by telling you a story about His Holiness, because this story, in a way, contains everything about this extraordinary man who has been one of my very greatest teachers, continues to be somebody I have a great, great reverence for. I was lucky enough to work with the Tibetans for a long time and to be initiated into Tibetan Buddhism. And through a set of graces, I got to be able to interview the Dalai Lama on the day that he won the Nobel Prize in Oslo. And it was a long interview and a very beautiful interview, because to be in the same room as His Holiness and to be able to ask him anything and to have him reply with such sweetness and such candor, he's the most honest, naked, open person to be with. It's actually quite shocking. And at the end of it, I was feeling very tottery because I felt so overwhelmed by the presence of this amazing compassion that radiating from him and his love. It's not a neutral love that you feel around him. It is a very deep personal love. He's radiating towards you. He's not concerned so much about himself. He's concerned about you. And so you feel, you never feel more extraordinary or more magical or more yourself than when you're with him. It's an extraordinary flowing out of the highest kind of love. At the end of this, I got up and I said, I'll never be in this situation. I had met him before, but this was a very special time to meet him. I said, I'll never be in this situation again. This is an amazing day when the world is crazy enough, finally, to recognize a saint for the Nobel Prize. And I'm able to talk to you. And he laughed and laughed. And I said, well, I'm going to ask you a question. What is the meaning of life? He roared. He did that, but he roared this amazing laugh. And he said, the meaning of life is to embody the transcendent. And it was an overwhelming moment, because I realized I was in the presence of somebody who was doing everything he possibly could to embody the transcendent. And that I had up to that moment thought that the mystical journey was about the light, about going into the light and experiencing the light. But now he had completely reversed it by really revealing that the whole point of the journey is to bring the light down into the being. And this goes back to the question you asked about India, because there was three major experiences. One was an experience of the divine light, which I was walking back from dinner in a seaside town that I love called Mahabalipuram. And as I was walking, my mind exploded gently, and I saw the divine light coming from everything. And I saw my own footprints radiating divine light. And then I was rather miffed because I noticed everybody else's footprints on. I thought, at least, you know, Buddha never experienced anything. And immediately, of course, everything was radiating this. And then the sea itself was chanting Om. So I experienced, I think, an aspect of divine identity. And about a week later, I was lying on my bed and I had a dream vision. And I began it as one soul in a million, million souls singing ecstatically to God of this great love that bound us. And then I experienced an impulse from the center of this great cloud of souls that said, you have to leave me now. You have to incarnate. You have to go down. And at that moment, it was like being cut apart by a knife. And the singing changed from being an ecstatic celebration of unity to this, oh my God, I will miss you so much. I will miss this so much. I love you so much. How can I bear to leave you? And realizing that that's at the center of incarnation, coming down with that longing to be back there. But here we are to experience that again. So that was an experience of emanation from the divine, and an experience of what it is to be in a body, why we're in bodies, to crawl back through all the different levels to that union and experience it in a body, in time. And then that aspect was completed because I had a dream. And in this dream, I was sitting on the beach in Mahabalipuram, which is very sacred to me. Mahabalipuram is a place where Shiva and Parvati, the divine marriage, has been worshipped for many centuries. It has golden temples dedicated to the alchemical transfiguration of the divine human. It is a holy, sacred place. And it has these amazing beaches which are empty and golden. And I was sitting on one of them. And this extraordinarily beautiful being came towards me. And I didn't know whether he was a man or a woman, or she was a man or a woman. I just knew that I was looking at the most beautiful being I had ever seen. And this beautiful being was entirely sacred and entirely embodied. And there was an erotic connection, but it wasn't a sexual connection. There was just this amazement and this love. And here she came towards me, lay down, and put her head in my lap. And I was amazed with love. And I said to this being, I said, "Who are you?" And the being said, "I am you." And I realized that I was being given a vision of who I was meant to become. I wasn't that person then, and I'm not that person now, but I'm traveling towards that person. Because that person was doing what the Dalai Lama said, the meaning of life is to do. That person was embodying the transcendent, and was embodying the transcendent as a sacred androgyne, somebody both very masculine and very feminine. And that, I think, has been the meaning of my journey, really. So those three experiences gave me the key to... You know, mystical experiences works like a Bach fugue. Are you familiar with Bach's music? Bach is receiving direct dictation from the divine, is my current theory. It's a theory of many people who have experienced Bach. But Bach begins by a theme, and then he does the most incredible things with that theme, and that theme reappears. So very often your initial mystical experiences are repeated in themes that gather enormously more significance as they go on. So those, my whole mystical life has been a fugue on those three experiences, one of identity, one of incarnation, and one of embodiment, because they're the key to the evolutionary consciousness, that we come from the absolute. We're incarnated here to integrate the absolute, and we're here to embody the absolute in sacred presence and then, of course, in sacred action that flows effortlessly from the joy and the ecstasy and the tenderness and the compassion and the deep suffering of the authentic divine presence. And we mustn't mix out the suffering, because when you mention Desmond and His Holiness, Desmond Tutu and His Holiness, you are after all talking about people who were forged in genocide, the long genocide of apartheid, and this terrible genocide that His Holiness has been at the core of. So their joy, their hope, their radiance is all the more amazing and all the more life-giving, because it arises out of a naked confrontation with evil and horror at their most extreme. And to me, they're both giving that sign about how we must live in a period in which this devastation and evil is really wreaking great havoc. But they're doing it with such lightness of soul that we can all learn from them.
It's quite transformative and very energizing and encouraging. Let's talk about that dark stuff.
Yes. You're talking to the right person.
The dark side, the dark night of the soul are extremely important to your thinking and feeling and writing and expressing and living.
Yes. Thank you for saying that, because that is so much the key, I think. Well, instead of answering the question, I'd love to quote a Rumi poem to you, which is a poem I've been working with all day with an amazing Iranian dancer. We're doing a film about Rumi and the different stages of the path to divine love, and she is enacting these different paths. And I hope you'll come and see it when it's done. Her name is Banafshe Sayad, and she's a genius. She's somebody who totally extended my vision of dance. But the poem that broke us open, which we worked the most intensely on, is the great poem. There are two great poems that Rumi wrote at the Dark Night, and I'm going to give you both of them because I love you. The first one is this one, and this is so extraordinary. And I didn't know it before Banafsheh shared it with me. It goes like this. Love comes with a knife, not with a shy question, and not with fears for its reputation. Love is a mad woman, working her wild schemes, running on the mountains, tearing her clothes off, drinking poison, and then quietly choosing annihilation. There are love stories, and then there is the obliteration into love. You have been walking at the edge of the ocean, holding your robes up to keep them dry. You must dive, dive under, dive deeper, dive 1,000 times deeper. Love flows down. Haven't you seen how the earth submits to the sky? Has the earth ever grown any worse for submitting like that? Untie the cords of your robe and shiver in a new kind of love. That is the complete poem about the Dark Night process, because it describes the moment when the divine appears in a life and says to the ego, you are so lucky because I am going to cut your throat personally. And I'm going to cut it personally because your time has come, and I'm going to organize for you the most perfect set of absolutely unspeakable catastrophes in your life that will make it impossible for you to play any of your old games any longer. You've been playing these games, but you've been sincere enough to get to this stage, and now you've got to this stage. I am going to kill you personally. And this represents the wisdom of the Prophet, who said in this great hadith, which is the core of the Dark Night Mystery, and the Dark Night Mystery is known in all of the great mystical tradition. And the Prophet says, I am going to kill you personally. This is Allah speaking. But since it is I who am killing you personally, I will pay you the blood money for the killing myself. And what I will give you is myself. So the mystery of the Dark Night is the key to what we are undergoing on the planet at the moment, because we're undergoing an evolutionary death birth, a death of all the fantasies and agendas that have brought us to this suicidal, matricidal moment in which we are committing suicide and we're killing the entire planet in the final orgy of our addiction to power, domination, exploitation. But at the same time, in the middle of all of that, a new birth of a new consciousness is taking place, partly as a result of that devastation. So the whole process is a Dark Night mystery. And those who have been through a Dark Night and who truly know that it is the greatest mercy know that the secret to getting through this time is surrender to the inevitable collapse of a civilization that really needs to collapse, because it is now psychotically out of control and completely incapable of dealing with the problems that its own madness has created. And knowing that helps you understand how this second poem of Rumi is applied to this entire crisis. This is the greatest poem ever written about the Dark Night, and it's written by someone who really lived it. I've lived it, and I could only get through it because I had his teaching. The Dark Night is too terrifying an experience to be got through unless you know from the mystics who have gone through it that it is not death and extinction, it is rebirth and resurrection. because you have to hold in there for months and years, as the world is now going through this process in which we will have to hold in there for months and years. But Rumi in this poem gives the key to the whole process. And this is the poem, it's only 10 lines and it's amazing. To me it's the key to what we're living, this death that's a birth. He says, the grapes of my body can only become wine after the winemaker tramples me. They're the two bravest lines in poetry. The grapes of my body can only become wine after the winemaker tramples me. I surrender my body like grapes to his trampling, so my inmost heart can blaze and dance with joy. And although the grapes go on sobbing, blood and screaming, I cannot bear any more anguish. I cannot bear any more cruelty. The trampler stuffs cotton in his ears and says, it is I who am the master of this work. You can deny me if you want. You have every excuse. But when through my passion you reach perfection, you will never be done praising my name. Isn't that amazing? And it's the total experience, because Rumi is understanding it, as you understand at a certain stage of love, that the one thing that is between you and the divine is you. Al-Halaj says, between me and you, there is only me. Take away the me, so only you remain. The dark night is the taking away of the me. And Rumi's got to the stage when he can say, I have to die. My grapes have to be squeezed out for the wine to be made. And he has to surrender completely to this process, so that while the horror is going on, his heart will be in a state of ecstatic acceptance and joy, so my inmost heart can blaze and dance with joy. And the beauty of the poem is that it doesn't stop the atrocity of the process, because Rumi, the human being, as the world will go through this immense crisis, is weeping blood and screaming, this is too much. Stop this process. Stop the anguish. Stop the cruelty. Stop the revelation of the complete corruption of government. Stop the revelation of the complete addiction to the bottom line of the corporations. Stop the revelation of the total tribalism of the religions, unable to cope and foaming with fundamentalism at the time when we need universal mysticism. Stop the fatuity of the New Age that is talking about magical solutions and rainbow bridges appearing in 2012, when there are 2 billion people starving on this landscape and this world, and forests being destroyed and seas being polluted. Stop this madness, this pain, this horror, this cruelty, this delusion. I mean, that is what we're all saying at some level. And yet, there is another voice that is trying to get through to us, which is the voice of God in the last part of the poem, which says so beautifully and compassionately, I am the master of this work. This is my dance. This is my healing process. This is my destruction to create. This is my death process that is a rebirth process. And you can deny me if you want. You have every excuse, because it is horrible and it's so hard. But if you hang in there and trust me and love me and do the inner work and act from that inner sacred consciousness in reality as my servant and as my child and as my agent, then I swear to you that one day you will understand why you and the world have been put through so much, because there is so much coming in through this shattering. So much new love, so much new intelligence, so much heartbroken compassion that can open us at the most primordial levels. So many new visions of radiant sacred embodiment, and a whole new vision of putting sacred consciousness into action that can profoundly change the history of the world. All of this is being given now through the agency of this tremendous dying. And when through my passion you reach perfection, when a new humanity is born, as it will be, then you will never be done praising my name, because you will see that behind all of what you called chaos, All of what you experienced as destruction, all of what you suffered as madness, there was an order and a love directing it all and helping those who cooperated with it birth a wholly new level of divine embodied consciousness. And that is the mystery, I think, of what we're living.
So, you know, I would say amen and we would be quiet, and my job is to continue to probe.
Probe on. It's like being these alien probes, isn't it? But it's much more fun, actually, because they always sound frightful. You go up there and they stick things into you. You're not doing that to me, are you?
No. You've shared quite publicly some of the personal experience you just described.
Yes.
With a guru, a teacher, to whom you gave your heart and
yes.
and treasure, and she rejected you for the way you were created in terms of your affections.
Well, no, I think it was a very different thing, actually, that went on. I think...
So tell the story.
No, I think that was one definite version of the story, but I think that there was another really important aspect of the story. First of all, you know, this happened 15 years ago, and I now see my whole relationship with Meera in a much more beneficent and holy way.
But tell us who she was.
Mother Meera is a guru who I met when she was 19 and I was 28, and I experienced a great deal of joy and beauty in her presence and became her devotee and wrote about the spiritual transformation that being her devotee as the living divine gave to me. And then what happened was is that I fell in love with a young man when I was in my 40s, early 40s, and it was such an obviously holy love for me that I imagined that she'd be thrilled because, my God, aren't what we're supposed to be doing uniting our bodies with our souls? This is what I thought the whole Mother Revelation was about, the integration of the light and the body, embodying the transcendent. And she said, no, you've got to leave him and you've got to marry and you've got to become a heterosexual. And at which moment I realized that she couldn't possibly be completely awake, otherwise that would be a very insane reaction. But it was a very painful shift because I had to leave her and had to choose this divine experience that I was living with my future husband. And to do so, I had to go through death, because I had to lose the greatest love that I could ever have imagined experiencing, which was my love for her. But over the years, I've been able to reclaim my love for her. But to see her as trapped at a moment of her destiny, when she, if she'd been able to embrace who I was, she really would have been who she said she was. Mm-hmm. And maybe what happened between us has given her in the years between an extraordinary opportunity to become grander and larger, just as it's given me the supreme opportunity of my life, which came in two different ways. It came in understanding that I had a direct connection with the divine beyond religion, beyond gurus, beyond any kind of mediation, and that was a thrilling liberation. And it gave me the revelation of Tantra, because being loved and loving so completely another human being, as both Eric and I did love each other for a long time, and sticking with that person and them sticking with you as your life goes through horror, because we had death threats for 3 years, and it was an agony beyond agony, but to know that somebody loves you enough to be with you through that, and to discover the holiness, not just of the heart's affections, but of the body's affections, and to experience the divine in sexuality and consecrated sexuality, that was an immense freedom from the hidden dualism and schizophrenia of the transcendental tradition. You see, there are two kinds of mysticism. There is the mysticism that is obsessed with the transcendent light and really believes that the ultimate awakening is a relationship with the light. You go off into the light, you become one with the light, you drop the body, you drop relationships, you drop the world becomes an illusion, only the light is the final reality. There's a half-truth in that which is tremendously sacred, but if you make it the whole truth, it becomes a dangerous lie. Because the other half of the truth is that the light has taken form, and the form is totally sacred because it is the embodied light. And you and I are totally holy and totally blessed and totally loved just as we are, because we are the embodied light, and the light is embodying itself in us, not to make us feel inferior to it, but to give us the energy and the rapture and the passion and the joy and the peace to live that sacred experience in the world. But that requires blessing your body, blessing your sexuality, blessing your being here, blessing being in this creation, blessing the creation, blessing the mother. It requires adoration of the divine feminine.
Which leads to sacred activism.
Yes.
Where you cannot...
Directly, actually.
Yes, indeed. So, in these waning moments before we have Q&A,
yes,
tell us how that has led to this book, An Expression of Sacred Activism. But please, friend, don't leave out the fact that you grew up in an imperial political structure.
Right.
And you live in the U.S.,
yes,
which is the strongest
empire,
albeit declining empire in
happily
the world.
Happily declining. And you're being liberated, my friend.
So speak of that, please, now.
Well, thank you. That's the most perceptive question I've been asked for a very long time, because very few people have ever made the connection, which I make all the time, between having been brought up in an imperial class and living in the empire here. And one of the reasons why I feel I can see so clearly the madness of this imperial madness is because I've already lived it in my own family and heard all the crazy explanations for why you impose power and why it's actually good for the people you're killing to be killed by you, because that'll help them get closer to democracy so that you can rape their resources. This is the logic of empire. I've heard it since a child. I know what it is. And I also know that empires are fantastically blind to their own shadow, because to do what they do, they have to be able to justify it at such a crazy level that craziness has to be sustained, otherwise the long list of their atrocities and their crimes would overwhelm them with nervous breakdown. So I understand the level of denial in this culture. But you asked me the question, how did the Tantra come to sacred activism? Once you understand that the universe is a sacred marriage between the divine masculine and the divine feminine within the mystery of the one, between the absolute Father, the silence, the great peace, the light, and the creations of the light manifesting, the Mother. Once you realize that, you realize that you are here to embody that. And that means that you're here to embody the silence and the peace and the grandeur and the ultimate eternal freedom of the absolute transcendent, and to embody the passion and the heartbreak and the intensity and the tenderness and the compassion and the deep mutual interdependent feeling of the Mother, and to act from that marriage in ways that enable this dimension to be transformed. Because if you can birth the marriage of opposites inside yourself, you slowly become divinized. Your heart becomes a sacred heart, your mind becomes illumined, and slowly your body also begins to transform. And that enables you to be an agent of massive transformation in the world. And we've reached the point where all of the old visions of mysticism and all of the old visions of activism are bound to fail. Mystics are addicts of transcendence, narcissists of self-experience. Activists are now self-righteous narcissists who are blaming everybody else for their own unacknowledged shadow. That's the shadow of both. So now what we have to do is to bring the best of the mystic together with the best of the activist. And this came to me in a tremendous dream with which I'll end, because this is really at the core of everything that I've been doing. It was a dream about a marriage. I've been talking about the mango and the stingray. There's been a lot of the marriage going on in our wonderful conversation, just as it is between us. I had an experience of the Christ in Coimbatore when my father was dying, and I had saw him alive at the end of the church, and I felt this molten wave of passion come into me. And then I went outside and saw a crippled man with no arms and no legs, and I heard the voice of the Christ saying, "Look at what the world really is. You are a narcissist. You've been playing with these experiences. You've got to dedicate everything that you are to trying to wake up people to the fact that the world is in extreme danger, and that the only solution is to plunge into divine transformation and then act on every level from that new sacred consciousness, because that's going to enable the creation of a new world." This was rather an intense message, as you can imagine. But the question remained, what is the birthing force of this new world? So I thought about that at the deepest level and tried to experience it at the deepest level. And then I had a vision, which is at the core of this book, which I hope it will mean something to you. And in this vision, I saw two rivers of fire going towards the sea and meeting in an immense nuclear explosion, but it wasn't a destructive explosion. It was a massively beautiful explosion of nuclear love in action, a new creative force. And I heard the words, "When the river of the fire of the mystic's passion for God meets the river of the fire of the activist's passion for justice, then a third fire is created, which is the fire of love and wisdom and action. And with that fire, everything can be transformed and a wholly new world can be built." And that was when I really began to understand what's at stake in sacred activism, which is the ending of the false separations between prayer and action, masculine and feminine, absolute and transcendent, and the bringing of humanity into a unified force field in which people deepen their sacred consciousness, not to sit back and just look at the world as an illusion, but to go out into the world armed with ecstasy and peace and joy and passion and work with the divine consciously to recreate and transform the world and become instruments of the birth. This is what I deeply am experiencing myself in obviously a very flawed and fragmentary way. But I know is here, this force is here, and this force is doing miracles. And this force is destined to help us birth the new world, but we have got to get going. It is very late, and we are very paralyzed. But this force is here, and it can help. And this book is my roadmap to how to be able to come into relationship with this force and help birth it. And that's what I've been trying to do with my own life.
And your vision is nothing less than the transformation of the entire world. Yes. And I really appreciate the way you lay it all out here. And it's quite practical. I have to ask two more questions, simply because I think they're essential. One has to do, and you're going to have to probably point us to chapters, but one has to do with joining a community that is, yes, you know, not one of these... another church. It's not not the Church of Andrew. It is about...
Alas, no. Thank God, no. What a terrible thought.
But it
is... have to turn up every Sunday to worship myself.
But it is about creating communities throughout the world. So just speak a little bit about that. And then I have one more quick question.
Well, I think it's quite obvious to all of us in this room that we cannot do this alone. It is not just a private transformation. You have to do great aspects of it privately, because God speaks to the soul from solitude to solitude. But then when God has spoken loudly enough, you find yourself one with all other beings. And then it's very, very important to really organize this great transformation, because what I think everybody can see is that what you might call the destructive forces are brilliant at organizing themselves, And the forces of the birth are catastrophically individualistic and chaotic, which is one reason why this huge evolutionary force is not yet moving humanity strongly enough. So what I created, and it's my website, do go and have a look, it's called Networks of Grace, because it suddenly occurred to me that the people who want to bring the birth in should be at least as organized as Al-Qaeda or the fundamentalist organization. And Al-Qaeda actually organizes itself by between 6 and 15 people meeting around a cause, pooling their resources, really working together to do something transformatory. So I thought, why on earth can't we? Why can't we get together around a heartbreak, a passion, a cause, with people who feel like we do, and start pooling our energies and our synergies and our creativity and our resources in ways that make us profoundly joyful, rescue us from this paralysis, rescue us from our catastrophic individualism, and start making us feel as if we are not helpless. Because the fundamental illusion of our death machine is that we are all helpless and that there is nothing we can do against the corporations, the governments. Well, there is something we can do. We can organize a mass global revolution of love in action through networks of grace that are interconnected. And that is what I am trying with my friends and to do. And without community of that kind, a radicalized mystical love force that's meeting to directly engage with all of the major problems, we will die out. But with that love force in place, we will be able to steer, through the grace of God, humanity through this death process and create the structures of the birth in the death process to give people hope and strength so that they can see that something new is emerging and that something new wears the face of a universal mysticism, a universal compassion, a total celebration of the creation, the holiness of animals, a real program of radical justice on every level. And that's our task. That's the task of those like you and me who are caught in this immensely tempestuous period. But if we can really get aligned with that birthing energy and come together in these sacred networks, then there is nothing that won't be given us, because this is the way the Holy Spirit will organize the transformation.
I'm going to magnanimously bracket my last question so that we can go to the questions here, because I know some people have some, and we only have 10 minutes. So if you have a question for Andrew, please raise your hand. Let me call on you. Here's one here, and here's one here, right there, please.
First of all, a very fascinating conversation.
Thank you
so
much.
Two questions that I have. The first one is, from my studies, I've noticed that your opinions somewhat are similar to the perennialist school of philosophy.
Yes.
So would you like to say a bit on that?
Well, please.
The second question is related to... So when you talk about this universal mysticism...
Yes.
Where does that leave the room for the individualistic religious mysticism that we already have, like Kabbalah and Sufism?
Yes, wonderful question. Wonderful question. First of all, I'm not a philosopher, I'm a mystic. I'm not describing something I've read in books. I'm describing something that, through the grace of God, I'm experiencing. What I've done is take a journey into the divine, and through the grace of the divine, I have partially woken up. And I've been able to be initiated in many of the major mystical systems. And I've done that not because I wanted to learn new knowledge. I've done that because I needed real direction. And in the course of that, I discovered that all of the different traditions were describing aspects of the same extraordinary journey. So perennialist philosophy is an intellectual way of actually describing the enormous birth of radical direct experience of unity with creation that is at the core of all of the mystic revelations, simply because you cannot have a mystical revelation without knowing that, because that's what it teaches you. Do you see what I mean? You see what I mean? So the second question, what was your second question? Yes, what happens to the religions?
Right. Well, not just religions, but
the mystical systems
that are already inside the religions.
Yes. Well, Rumi said a beautiful thing. He said, when you are going to the Kaaba, to the black stone at the core of the universe, you quarrel about the different interpretations of things. When you have the experience of the Kaaba, you sit in silence and you smile at each other. So the most essential thing is whether you are a Kabbalist or a Sufi or a Christian or a Buddhist or an Amerindian Indian, is not to rest in any of the boxes that that might assume, but to take the journey as deeply as you can, so eventually you have the experience of non-dual unity, at which moment you are given a choice. You can either stay with that experience and get out of all of the religious boxes altogether and become a universal mystic, or you can decide to go back into your own tradition and transfigure it from within to reveal its own deepest meaning. For example, Rumi was a universal mystic. He could speak to anybody who'd ever had a final realization. And yet he remained a Muslim because at the core of Islamic mysticism is this revelation of unity, and he irrigated that revelation at the core of Islam. Thomas Merton opened to Buddhism and to Hinduism but remained a Christian because at the core of the Christian revelation is a revelation of the unity with the Godhead and with the creation through the Trinity. So he was refreshing that from his non-dual experience. So what is being born on the earth at the moment is a universal mysticism, which doesn't leave out any of the other mysticisms, but which really sweetly challenges them all to get real about helping people to have the very experience that would end their claims to any kind of exclusiveness. Because once that non-dual experience, you've had it, you recognize its appearance in all the places where it's being loved and celebrated. And so the game of being a Sufi or a Christian or a Hindu or whatever, that ends and you become a divine human being appreciating all of the traditions because all of them contain hints of this fabulous music.
There's a question here.
Does that make sense to you in the audience?
Total.
Good. Thank you for letting me answer.
Go ahead and speak.
What a wonderful question. Very profound question.
Who is Caroline Blackwood?
Who is Caroline Blackwood? Caroline was somebody I lived with for 2 years in my 20s and was the widow of Robert Lowell and also second wife of Lucian Freud. She was a very extraordinary writer and she was a very frightening and terrible and beautiful presence in my life. And if I knew the answer to who was Caroline Blackwood, I would be a very wise person, because let me tell you, she was Carly in a bottle.
Last question, yeah, right there. Thank you.
My question just relates to sort of a basic, why can we not go towards the transcendental? Closer. I'm just recalling a story about Tiananmen Square and a mother mourning her son had been shot and killed in China, and waiting for the government to apologize, which they never would.
No.
And she stated that she felt that instead of letting people deal with the transcendence and the mystical and their higher power, that we are fed materialism and the society is given, you know, more jobs, credit cards, shopping, just to placate you against this horrible, you know, undercurrent or, you know, human rights violations which went on in China. And I think that's really the problem, that people won't.
Well, I think that you're saying something very important, but first of all, what's your name? Susan, I don't think anybody in this room, and I hope nobody in this room, really heard me saying that we are not here to establish a profound relationship with the transcendental. This is the ground of realization. Non-dual experience is, by definition, related to the transcendental. Because you can't be having a divine experience of your divinity and of the divinity of other people without having an experience of the divine. And that is a transcendental experience, but it's also increasing an experience of the divine being incarnated in matter. So what has happened is that the religions have taken one half of that experience and deified it, the light, the light, the light, and therefore falsified it. And the materialistic religions, the religions of consumerism, have deified matter, not remembering that matter is a manifestation of light. So they're both exaggerations and hysterias that have to be healed by a sacred marriage of the transcendent and the immanent. There's this great Hindu poet which said these beautiful phrases. He said, "My father is the transcendent absolute, and my mother is the embodied Godhead, and I am the child dancing for them both." So what I'm talking about is not at all abandoning the transcendent, but grounded in the transcendent, love this world, love your body, love each other, love animals, love the creation, because all of those things are totally holy and sacred because the transcendent is living in them as them, right? And that is the experience that changes everything. It separates you from the old religions that have deified salvation as being elsewhere, because you realize it's in this experience of being here in that state. And it separates you from materialism, obviously, because materialists are worshipping a false god. They're not worshipping the light. They're worshipping goods.
It is 8:15. My wonderful friend, Justin, is saying it's now time to wrap it up. I want to thank you all for coming. This is a very busy time.
You are so nice to have come out tonight. Thank you.
Wonderful energy. Andrew will be out front signing books, and we'll all be out there, and I hope to be able to greet you. But thank you very much. Thank you very much, Andrew Harvey.
Pleasure. Thank you very, very much. Love you too.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.